Colonel Featherby, Reel 11. Now, on your, you went into the reserve, the Territorial Army Reserve officers. Could you explain the status of that list and how you seem to have become also TA Colonel East Midlands? And
yes, now the TA have an active list and a retired list. The retired list really is only just a list of retired officers. It doesn't really apply that you have any real responsibility to further service, but you're there, I think, to be called upon if absolutely necessary. And you can switch back from the retired list to the active list. And it isn't something you consciously do. It's what records tell you you do, or what records tell you where you are. Now, I retired in the March in the 69, and I noticed from this record sheet that in 1969, I'm not quite certain on what date I was made territorial colonel, that's a full colonel rank, at East Midlands District Headquarters at Woodborough. And I'm pretty convinced now that Major General Gordon Finlinson was in fact the officer commanding East Midlands District. That lasted, I would think, about a year to 18 months, and it was disbanded.
Now, what was the, let's look at first, what was the role of the, what was your role as TA Colonel at the East Midlands District?
I was there, strictly speaking, to advise the General commanding the district on matters relating to territorial army, regardless of whether they were gunners, infantry, or... And each district commander would have a territorial colonel.
Now, what sort of advice would you give? What sort of questions came up? What advice did you give?
Wide-ranging questions, wide-ranging problems, such as pay and allowances, how long can a territorial soldier be expected to train during the week, officer recruitment, is it realistic to feel that officers can do every weekend in a month, dress regulations, anything appertaining to the terms of service for territorial soldiers would be referred to you for advice. Not necessarily accepted, but for advice.
And any other role, or was that it?
No, there was a role as in the civil defence cell at, I think it was RAF Cranwell in those days, and dealing with emergency planning in the event of nuclear war.
What sort of thing did that involve?
An exercise about once a year.
What would happen on the exercise?
Well, it all disappear into this bunker in Cranwell, and somebody would simulate a nuclear attack, and you would respond accordingly.
This is Cranwell Airfield.
Cranwell,
base. Where about? Sorry, where is Cranwell? Sorry,
I was in Lincolnshire.
And what would happen? I mean, were you just in the bunker, or would you have something to do in the bunker?
Yes, I would have the coordination of reserve forces, if you like, to try and move them about the countryside to carry out tasks set by whoever was in charge at that time of the bunker. I mean, there was in those days, if you remember, there were regional seats of government commanded by a member of the cabinet, and there were about 8 regional seats of government throughout the UK. There was one in Nottingham, and Lincolnshire was Cranwell, and they didn't come down for these kind of exercises. But there would be a senior regular officer in charge, and then there would be a number of people brought in to work the system.
How realistic do you think the exercises were, given that if there'd been a nuclear strike, what reserve forces at the outside of the bunker would be a question that some people might say, you know?
Well, I think this is where the whole thing was totally unrealistic. I mean, the question of whether in the event of nuclear war, you would find that the TA soldiers would all of a sudden rush to the drill hall and leave their families in the garden, so to speak. I mean, I just don't think it would have worked. I mean, it's not like 1939 when war started. South Nazis ours left their buses outside the drill hall, who were bus drivers, and just signed on. It's a different ball game leaving your family in the event of 28 nuclear warheads dropping on the UK. You'd never have gotten picked up.
What was the bunker like? I mean, you know, just to describe.
Well, it was just an underground set of rooms with signalling equipment, wirelesses, and also landlines to various other outposts. And for instance, it was all connected to the observer core system so that we could get information about possible nuclear strikes.
How deep was it? Was it far underground?
No, that one wasn't particularly far underground. The one in Nottingham was quite deep. I mean, there would be police representatives, there would be representatives of the local authorities, ambulance services, fire brigade people. They all seconded one guy to the allotted desk in the bunker.
What was the Nottingham bunker? Where was that at? It may be secret.
It's at Chalfont Drive, and it hasn't been activated for years and years and years.
Who would go there? How did that fit into the system, if Cranwell was the...
Why I went to Cranwell, I'm not quite certain, but there was certainly a similar bunker in Chalfont Drive, and somebody else presumably went there. I don't know where they were staffed from. It was all supposed to be terribly fresh at that time.
Now, what about the person you were giving advice to was the General Gordon Finlayson, I think. Now, could you... what was he like, and what was his role in things? He was General Officer Commanding Eastern District, East Midlands District.
He's a very nice chap, and we've met him before when he was our CRA, because he was a gunner officer. And so I knew him quite well, and he's a delightful man. So he knew us as well, of course.
Was he sympathetic to the advice you gave?
On the whole, yes, because... like a lot of other things, a directive comes down from above to a district commander who has to implement it. And he will turn to you and say, well, this impinges upon the terms and conditions of the territorial soldier. What do you think, Peter? And I would say, well, I think that's okay. I think it's too much. I think you're asking too much of them. And he would carry that message with him. Whether he accepted it, it's another matter. It still works the same way, even today.
Was he sympathetic to the South Nazis Hussars and their various predicaments? It seems to have been this General Walker that dealt with the actual changeover. But yeah.
Yes, I mean, he was. He's a great South Nazis Hussars fan.
Anybody else or anything else about your time there? You were there about 18 months, so 69 through to 70.
Then East Midlands District was disbanded completely. It disappeared into Eastern District headquarters at Colchester. They expanded, they reduced the number of districts and increased them in size.
And were you transferred to Colchester?
Yeah. And then I retired from that job in 1974.
And it was the same job?
Same job.
That didn't change. And was Finlayson there to the end? Or did
no, he retired. He disbanded the district.
Who replaced him?
It was a chap called Scott Barrett.
And how did you get on with him?
Because they were at Colchester, quite honestly, I didn't see an awful lot of them. It was quite easy to nip up to Woodborough and Nottingham and see them, but we went down to Colchester probably 5 or 6 times a year, or alternatively, on their visits to the area, they would ask me to come along with them. And then after Scott Barrett, well, there were a number of different Peter Hudson, I think, was the last one, General Peter Hudson.
Were there more TA colonels advising these generals at Colchester than you? So it was quite a responsible position.
There was one at that time per district.
Now, what about...
Sorry, having said that, I think there was probably... There was probably another TA colonel who was responsible for the AVR 1 regiment school organisations. As far as the ordinary TA was concerned, you had one per district.
Now, what about the Southwold Hussars during this period? From when you left them, 69 through to 74. How were they faring as far as you were concerned?
I had very little to do with them directly, and I do take the view that they're best left alone and let them get on with it themselves, because I think they want old colonels hanging around, and so clearly it is for the battle commanders of the subsequent period of time to decide and tell you what they felt. How successful they were. They were very successful with the problems of the role.
What were the problems?
The problems of the role.
Had you identified these problems before they took it over? I mean, you know.
I think that we could see problems with the role. The normal method of training of a gunner officer to be at the gun end. A junior gunner officer would be on the gun end, and he would learn his trade with the guns and firing the guns. And then, at about captain's level, he would become an observation officer. The problem with being an OP battery was you had to provide a considerable number of OP officers who would be sent out to their regular regiments in Germany for their annual camp. And they would be trained in observation duties. Because of the shortage of numbers of guns, it was difficult to give them the gunner training which they would have normally had if they'd have been in a gunner regiment. So you did get some highly skilled observation officers with very limited view, very limited training at the gun end. So they did tend to get a little bit lopsided in their attitudes towards gun training.
So they were basically were no good as GPO, not necessarily no good, but not as good as they should have been as GPO or command post officer.
I mean, they some of them, and they've been in for some considerable number of time, had probably fired more rounds at a target than regular officers. And they could do the OP work on the back of their head. But you see, they had really very little experience of commanding large numbers of soldiers, because they only had themselves, a driver, and probably a 4-3-2, a couple of gunners, and a survey sergeant, in a small packet, which used to go off to camp and come back again. So there was an imbalance in the training of those officers.
Now, when they sent out, you mentioned officers, but presumably they'd take their OP party with them.
They would.
Would they work with them, or would the party be sent to work with a regular OP officer? Or would they stay as a team?
They would stay as a team.
And so that was one side of things. When did you next? I mean, what's the next thing that happened in your time, or the next time you had any real dealings with it? In 74, you left as TA Colonel to the Eastern Division. What did you be? What happened then?
I got down here 74 to 79. I was ADC to the Queen. Now you're going to say, well, what did I do? I did absolutely nothing for 5 years, apart from getting an automatic invitation to the garden party.
It's an honorific, though.
Yes.
So, was it important to you, that sort of honorific? Was it important? You mentioned yourself, you came from a council flat, you know, not the, you know, and here you were at ADC to the Queen. Was that the sort of big thing?
Well, it depends how you want to bum it up, this password. Yes, I'm delighted. I mean, it's rather like, I suppose, one could have had like LOB for command and legend and all the rest of it. James Gunn got one. Tom Formanati got one, but in those days they were fairly easy to get. And the whole honours business has changed, and this is a very nice, simple way of rewarding somebody for long service at no cost to the government or anybody else. And you're entitled to put insignia on your uniform, which is E2R, and then when you're retired, you get a smaller one, you see. And it was good fun. I mean, they sent you a set of instructions that said, if you ever have to be on parade on a horse, you will be supplied with a public horse. And a public horse is apparently a police horse. I never had to do a thing. So, yes, I was delighted to be appointed, but it really didn't mean great.
And then the next thing?
Well, the next thing, I was asked, I stood down in 79, and then I was asked to be Honorary Colonel of the Nottinghamshire Army Cadet Force, and I served from 1982 to 1988.
Now, what did that entail? Could you perhaps give us a bit of a background to the Nottinghamshire Army Cadet Force?
Well, the Nottinghamshire Army Cadet Force at that time would have had something like about 100 adults, officers and adult instructors, and something in the region of 600 cadets in detachments of 30 or 40 around the county of Nottingham. They train in the evenings and sometimes on Sunday mornings, weekends. They would go to annual camp for 10 days. They are staffed up by civilians under the authority of the TA Association, who are really responsible for the Army Cadet.
How are they recruited? They're not sort of the schools, are
No, they're not CCFs, not Combined Cadet Forces. They are Army Cadet Force, and they are run by detachment commanders who receive some pay and allowances for their work, and they recruit young people from, I think, the age of 14, girls and boys.
And where are they based? I mean, do they have their own premises, or do they hire?
Yeah, they're normally based in Nissen hut-type accommodation in the grounds of either a school or a drill hall. I mean, we've got one at Bulwell at the back.
And what exactly do they do?
They do simple, basic archery training, rifle drill, marching, and then when they go on camp, they do firing. It's really a youth organisation. It's also very valuable as a source of recruits for the regular army, because I think something like 10% of them were end up as regular soldiers.
What about territorials? I mean, was that
we never managed to achieve any flow from the Army Cadet Force to the territorial army, and you still can't.
Why not? There must be a reason, because you'd have thought that the volunteer, I mean, it's almost the same commitment.
Well, first of all, a lot of them leave at the age of about 16 when they find girls, and I suppose nowadays they find them a bit earlier than 16, and they leave. Those that go on and live with it become senior NCOs, Army Cadets. They may be wearing sergeant stripes, normally the stripes, sergeant stripes, and might be sergeant major. Those that are really good enough, when they reach the right age, can switch to be adult instructors. There seems to be no desire to take down, if you like, your sergeant stripes and go into the TA and become a gunner. And I think that is the fundamental problem, that there is no way in which the TA can accept an Army Cadet Force Sergeant with Sergeant stripes up. And there is no way in which an Army Cadet Force Sergeant wants to come and be gun of loggins.
So, I mean, did you try?
Oh, yes.
Because it seemed, that's a very clear reason why not, but it seems a tempting sort.
We try because they're in the drill hall, they come into the drill hall, we allow them to train on our equipment, we allow them to do gun drill on our guns, we take some of them to camp with us to encourage them, but the number who go to the, from the cadet force to the TA is far less than those that go to the regular army.
Now, what was your job as honorary colonel?
Well, pat the little boys and girls on the head occasionally, really. The usual kind of thing, you present prizes at the annual camp and you preside at the dinner and just keep an eye on them. You help to choose the CO of the... you have a say in who commands the Army Cadet Force, who's the commandant, who's the deputy commandant, and you talk with the association about cadet matters.
So a sort of benign figurehead and still no particular contacts with the South Officers' Hours?
Other than serving on certain of the committees that deal with welfare, with benevolence, with the old comrades, things like that. I had no tactical role whatsoever in the way in which...
And you hadn't become an honorary colonel at that time, had you?
No. The next thing was, after I finished with the Armed Cadet Force, in 1989 to 94, I... became honorary colonel of the South Lots Hussars.
Now, that's of course very relevant to us. What exactly did that end? I mean, firstly, were you expecting it, and how was the succession arranged?
I followed James Young.
So much as you had in the riff. Were you expecting it?
Yes, I suppose so, to be perfectly frank.
Who picked the honorary colonel? The previous honorary colonel,
I think the previous honorary colonel would say to the TA Association, you have quite a big say in who is the honorary colonel, and also to the gunners. Well, I think Featherby ought to do it. He's the senior, next senior one, and he's capable of doing it, and all the rest of it. So that's how it works.
Were you pleased?
Yes.
What was your role?
Well, again, very similar to the question of being an honorary colonel of the Armed Cadet Force. With a slightly, I suppose, more intimate relationship, perhaps with regular gunners who would come up and inspect the battery, and they'd probably see me at the same time and say, "Are you happy with what's going on?" And all the rest of it. You don't have a lot, you don't have any real responsibility for them. I mean, you are consulted, or should be consulted, about changes of dress, changes of honorary title. You would be perhaps be consulted about any changes in the drill hall. If they wanted to move a subunit from A to B, you would be asked whether you felt that you could recruit in that locality. These are the kind of things that an honorary colonel would be consulted about, and who would command the battery.
Now, who was commanding the battery when you took over in 89? You're not sure?
I'm not sure who were commanding during my period of tenure as honorary colonel.
That would seem to indicate that there was no particular problem, in a sense, with whoever it was.
Yes, that's right. We didn't seem to have any difficulties during that period, except ultimately when the options for change came about.
Now, well let's, so you had a smooth relationship with the commanding officers. It just slipped your mind, and perhaps we've dropped that in it. Anything. Now, what about this? What was the problem with options for change? When did that start?
Well, the next really difficult part period was the question of options for change, when it was clear the OP battery concept was to be rehashed and considered alternatives once again for the future of the Have-Nots as Ours.
Now, this options for change, it was carried out by who? Which government? Conservative or Labour? Just to give it a, it would be conservative. And this was a review of the organisation of the whole of the Territorial Army, was it, or just not just the South North Zone?
And the regular army.
And how was it affecting you then? There's this, you'd been an OP battery then, solidly from the time that Bexham had started, had founded that battery, right up. Its role hadn't fundamentally changed.
No. Yeah, it's gone up in strength and it come down in strength, but it was, its role was the same. And then government decided to bring in this review called Options for Change. One option was that the South Knots as Ours would disappear. There was some suggestion that further parachute troops were required, and we thought perhaps that might be a way out.
So very similar to what happened the first time around, because then you'd have been a question of you becoming a parachute.
Resurrected that kind of thing, that attitude. But eventually it was decided that the yeomanry regiments would form up into 100 regiment. And we were to be one of those batteries. The fight was between the South Knots as Ours Yeomanry and the Sussex Yeomanry, which was already in the 100 Regiment.
Now, what 100 Regiment was what? Was that a territorial regiment?
Territorial, yes, territorial regiment.
With detached batteries around the country.
Yes.
So, and this wasn't a question of observation battery, this is a battery.
This is going back to a proper gunner regiment.
Now, why were you in conflict with the Sussex Yeomanry?
Well, Sussex Yeomanry were already in 100 Regiment, but they weren't terribly well recruited. And we were. It's once again the syndrome of the highest number of soldiers you have, the stronger you are when it comes to a change of heart. So it was decided ultimately, after a considerable amount of correspondence, all of which is now in the Regimental Museum, all the letters that I wrote at the time. And
I'll come back to that. That's, well, no, let's deal with it now. How were you involved? It was, you were honorary colonel. What exactly was your role in?
What happens when something drastic like this happens is that a number of us, Arthur, James, myself, and the battery commander at the time, and get together and we try and produce a plot put the thoughts into the appropriate minds of generals and above. We had at that time a great ally in Sir Martin Farndale, who was at one time commander of the 1st Regiment and then commander in Germany of the, whatever it is, 1st Army, whatever it is, and who was very, very, very sympathetic to the South Knots as because, it's his RHA thing again. And
what
was
his
own master gunner at the time?
What is master gunner?
The master gunner is like the honorary colonel, if you like, of all the gunners. And he has a headquarters in Woolwich, and he's responsible for the regiment traditions, the uniforms, the recruitment in certain respects of all the gunner regiments, both TA and regular.